Post Harlan Mono Logics. Number 00034. Recorded on March 27, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Part 6. Chapter 34.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
The theme of, and I quote unquote, changes, right? Changes is sort of prevalent in rock music through the decades. You know, a couple examples off the top of my head of songs that are actually called changes, right? Black Sabbath, who I keep bringing up, right? They have their song Changes, which. I think it's terrible. I love Black Sabbath, but that song is eh. David Bowie, who I'm not a fan of, but he's got his song. And nothing's coming to mind immediately because I've got something on my mind already. Otherwise, one thing otherwise is what I want to get into a little bit here. Yes, right? The prog rock, progressive rock band from England. From the late 60s, early 70s, and on. Still in their broken parts, managing to put music out. They've got a new release coming out I've just seen a couple of days ago. But anyway, Yes has a song called Changes also, right? Changes. And it's on their... what year was that? I ought to know. I went to the tour, concert on the tour two different times. 90125 album. It was early 80s. The song was written in 81, but I don't know when it was recorded or released. 1983. Okay, here's 1983. Sorry about the delay there. I meant to have that in my mind already, but I failed. But I should have known, 1983, because, the album came out and everybody was like, yeah, because, we were a bunch of burnouts and shit, and Yes was like one of the top 10 burnout bands, stoner rock music and everything, and it had been a couple of years, and Yes were going through their own kind of changes, personnel. They often shifted personnel through time, obviously, but... there was a whole lot of changes going on, going out of the 70s and into the 80s, right? I talk about it frequently enough. You leave the analog era of the 70s and move into the digital era of the 80s. And Yes was like one of the most pompous prog rock bands, with the long 20-minute fucking songs. And they had to go through a transition of their own. To make some kind of sense with the rock music industry in the MTV era, right? Their last album in the 70s, which was the first album that came out while I was a fan of them, right? It was called Drama. One of those 1979 albums, I believe. 78, maybe, probably 79. And there were so many good albums done by all these old dinosaur rock bands. At the end of that analog era. And what was interesting with Yes, when they did Drama, they had the personnel change, and they brought in two guys from another English band who was a new wave band called the Buggles, right? And the Buggles had the song, they made the song that is on the Drama album called Into the Lens, but the Buggles version is called I Am a Camera, right? I Am a Camera. That was one of their real two songs of note from that time, really from their existence. The other one, however, was Video Killed the Radio Star, which happened to be the very first video that was ever played on MTV. So the transition from Yes out of analog into digital, out of the 70s into 80s, incorporated a couple of new wave guys into the band at the end of the 70s. So that start had happened, and it was kind of a slick transition, right? Kind of a slick transition. 90125 would be their first actual MTV generation release. And it was quite different. It was quite different. Not my favorite album in the world. It's got moments. It's high fucking quality. The engineering on it is incredible. The songwriting is incredible. But when you were a fan of Yes in the 70s, and that's what you like, the quote-unquote change that they went through to kind of get with the times a little bit, it left you wanting. It left you wanting. Nonetheless, 90125 was way better than anything that was out there at that time. You know, it was way better than anything else that was done. The best song on that entire LP. And the song that seems to harken back the most to the 70s in a lot of different ways, yet is clearly an 80s song, is this one, Changes, right? Yes, Changes. And like all the other rock songs that are titled or based on changes in general terms, the changes are almost always with respect to a broken relationship, right? And by that I mean a broken romance relationship. Well, I've been speaking to changes in character, which goes to changes in opinion and changes in belief and changes in worldview. It's this big sweeping change. It's an inner change. It's not environmental. It's an inside job. It's not an external thing. This romance, the changes that happen when a romance breaks, is kind of an external thing that impacts you internally, right? But there's other relationships in the world. They're not all necessarily just romance. You know, I can look at Yes, and instead of regarding it as it is so apparently a broken romance, you could kind of just shake the idea of romance out of that and look at it as just a broken alliance in general. I can look at the change in the song Changes as changing one's religion. Let me explain that briefly. I had frequently encountered a terrific interview of an Orthodox priest here out in Texas somewhere, right? And it was probably an hour or so in length. And he said all kinds of stuff about all kinds of stuff. And Orthodox priests are wonderful to listen to. They will blow your mind. They will blow your mind. Incredibly intelligent people, right? They have to be. And out of everything that he said, there's one thing that really like stuck out and stuck to me. That I walked away with, called a takeaway, right? And I got a takeaway, and I'm going to give it away. He posited this idea that I really hadn't much considered before. I mean, I sort of have in odd kinds of ways, but not in a whole sweeping way like he did. He made this statement on the lines of the fact that we as people, one and all, are, quote-unquote, religious by nature. Religious by nature. And what he means to say to that by that is, it's not necessarily the idea that everybody is seeking God on God's terms, like I'm talking about so continually, right? People believe what they believe, and whatever it is they believe in, they build some kind of religious practice around it. And that's why you may have heard me say things like, you know, atheism is a religion unto itself. It was not meant to be. But when you believe whatever an atheist believes, you start to build some sort of religion around it. You start to acquire particular icons, you know, men of science, that you venerate in your own way, and that is a religious practice, right? So, you know, what I'm getting to here is the idea in this song, Changes by Yes, that we can look at it in terms of a shifting alliance. It doesn't have to necessarily be a broken relationship in terms of romance, but it can be one in terms of our own beliefs. That's fucking heavy, but it works. Try the lyrics out, right? I love doing this with songs, too, by the way. Taking the obvious intent of a song and transposing it onto something else and see how it flies. This is a pretty good example, right? So I have, I'm talking really about my own self in my life, right? This is where we left off. This is where we take up changes that were happening in my life as a result of my alcoholism and addiction, right, that brought me down to my knees, to the bottom of all bottoms, right, bottom of the fucking well. I had to unlearn and relearn everything, and that process involved transformation that came as the result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, right, the noteworthy 12-step program. And you get halfway through, and we have to we come to a place where we have recognized quote-unquote defects of character, and now we are to lay them at God's feet, walk away, and allow Him to institute and initiate situations in our lives that will promote the change necessary. For me to enter in to that entire line of transformation began with a very dynamic shift of allegiances from one way of life to another, from one set of beliefs to another. I had to go from that burnout who had become alcoholic slash drug addict, and everything that I believed in that capacity to now a recovering person. A recovering has an entirely different set of beliefs. The entire transition from one set of beliefs to another doesn't happen overnight. But the stopping of one and the beginning of the next does. And it's an incredible moment in time. Not to say that it's like wondrous, not to say that it feels so great. It's just incredible that it happens. Which reminds me of another song off of Yes 90125. It can happen to you. It can happen to you. It can happen to me. It can happen to everyone eventually. But the song changes, right? Talking about this idea of transposing its apparent intent from romance into a changing of one's beliefs, right? Who could believe when love has gone, how we move on like everyone? Think of the breakups that you've had in your lives, the women that you dated, whoever you are, I don't know who you are, whoever you dated in your life. You went into that and perpetuated that with all this great intent, and you had all this wonder. It's like your life was made new. You were made young again. And yet it found a way to come unhinged, and the wheels fell off. And then in retrospect, you know, you remember you went through some hard time with hard feelings. You had to make some kind of an adjustment, but you know, in hindsight, it looks like you just simply kind of got up and dusted yourself up and moved on. And you moved on like everyone. We all go through this, right? Into change is that first leap. It's like tearing a fucking Band-Aid off. Where it's absolutely doable. And, you know, like I said, for me, all of this stuff was not immediate. The only thing that was immediate was basically shutting the door on the past. And starting little by little to believe in the possibility of a future. A different kind of future. With this, with even this smallest display of faith, right? And what I mean to say by that is, I did not come to God on God's terms. I screamed out for God in my desperate hour, in my foxhole prayer moment, not knowing where else to turn. And somehow, some way, God managed to configure an avenue for me that made sense to me to start to walk down step by step. And just by me taking part in AA, I fully believe it was recognized by God that I was doing what I can do to at least recognize him, even if it was not on his actual terms. And really, my first 19 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, my first 19 years of recovery was a personal relationship with God in that light, in that very peculiar light, you know, basically my own religion, that was not good enough forever, for eternity. It was good enough for the meanwhile. But I made that very small display of faith. I cried out to God, and something came into my life that led me to something else that would present me a path to rebuild myself, right? But it involved completely severing ties with the past and the way that I was and what I engaged with, right? When you're a newcomer in AA, every day, you know, people are telling you people, places, and things, people, places, and things, you know? And what that's all about is you stay out, away from the people, places, and things that you did when you was partying all the time. You do close the door on that past until you're strong enough to open it back up again. You don't enter into those situations with as much possibility as you have to accomplish that feat. It's not 100% possible. Everybody's got their challenges, you know, but you do the best you can. But my transformation began, and it was probably, you know, I talk about my early recovery, like especially the first and second year, and how fucked up I felt. And I talk about them as the worst times of my life, right? The end of my active addiction and alcoholism, right? Active partying, and the beginning of my recovery was just and I don't have words for it. It was just so hideous of a time for me. I was so... not I. You know, I was just so not I. I had been obliterated by my lifestyle, and I hadn't yet been put back together, you know? And it just sucked. It just sucked. But it was the single most important part of my life. That began the transformation that led me to where I am now. It ended the destruction and began the construction. It was really an incredible time. So out of that ugly and important and incredible time that was the end of my addiction and beginning of my recovery, my life had become a sequence of changes, of building character, and one of those changes in particular that I actually had mentioned briefly earlier, it's that objectification / dehumanization variable in my being, right? That's the kind of a, AA uses this phrase, singleness of purpose, and it's a positive thing, but this is kind of a negative way of looking at it. Like, I have a singleness of purpose, like a tunnel vision. I want what I want, I know what I want, and I seek it out, and I go get it. And anything that is extraneous to that want, right, my desire is probably the better word for it, is of no regard, you know? of no consequence. It doesn't exist. It may as well be dead, never have been born, never have been created. That's, you know, dehumanizing. I walk into a room, you know, I could give examples of it. I hate to, but just to make it clear, you know. If there's somebody of interest to me, I will basically ignore everybody else. You know, in my age and maturity, I may know enough to be cordial to people as I pass by and blow them off, but that's just a way of blowing them off. I'm only interested in what I'm interested in. I never really had reason to bother to stop and smell the roses, to engage the entire moment for what it is, right? Always moving too quick, always focused on my base desire. It doesn't have to be base, just whatever my desire is, you know? Efficiency. Nazi-like fucking efficiency had always been the way that I operated. Now, I still have efficiency, but I have learned, and it's, you know, it's probably no mistake that God managed to pick me up and plunk me down in the South, where the general atmosphere of the quote-unquote world has a cultural element to it that incorporates more of a laid-back attitude. You know this, I know this, right? And that laid-back attitude involves a slowing of time, a deprioritizing of things, of, that's not even the right way to say it. Slowing down time and then making what's important less important. Is there a word for that? I should make one up. You know, a basic common realization that nothing is really all that fucking important in the grand scheme of things. We're up in metropolitan New York City. Whatever's on your mind is the most important thing in the world, and you trample over people to get what you want. Raised in that, and it becomes you. It's an environmental impact, right? So no mistake that I got plunked down in the South as part of the, you know, basic table set up to initiate the changes that were necessary in me, right? And I believe I was down South, at least in part, to work on this particular category of shit, this objectification / dehumanization of people. Now, with this, I had like this, you know, the Mr. Spock, what do you call it, temperament, right? The INTJ temperament type, the personality type. If you understand Mr. Spock from Star Trek, where everything is just logic, emotion is taken out of it. Anything actually, quote unquote, human is just completely shoved down and eradicated. I had that basic temperament, you know. People don't like that. And I had to learn in my life to kind of dress it up, accessorize it a little bit, to make it a little bit more cordial and approachable. But I was never an approachable person. Always intimidating, still intimidating. I don't mean to be, I just am. But once upon a time, I wasn't just intimidating, I wasn't even approachable. Now at least I'm approachable. Why? Because my empathy, which I once lacked, exists. Sympathy, which I once lacked, exists. I got time for you. If you're going to come and talk to me, I'm going to take a step back out of whatever I'm doing and give the minute, you know? And I'm not doing it out of obligation or duty or anything like that. It's actually the way I like to go. I have become Southern in that regard, right? The objectification part of it, that was very specific to this fifth step that I talked about earlier with my AA sponsor, was the objectification of females, right? And I'm telling all this to lead into a story, an interesting story, I think, anyway. You may not. Your results may vary. I'll have a sip of coffee while you decide for yourself. It was the objectification of females that he recognized. So when I go into a room and it's a room with females in it, I go to the female that interests me and I have no regard at all for the other ones. They were sexual objects. Objectification. Object, right? Key word in there. Root word. So he put it on me to put into practice the exercise of befriending women who I had no regard for, right? Instead of just blowing them off of having no value because they had no sexual value to me. They weren't attractive, is what I'm trying to say, right? To me, anyway. Now I had to go and learn to be friends with them. Which I did, you know, which I did. And when I learned how to be friends with them, I even had to learn, even came to learning to become friends with those who I'm attracted to, right? And be able to put the attraction aside to focus on the friendship. It was really very good orderly direction. It yielded a lot of results. Some of the results, you know, went like this. You know, it was an exercise in friendship, and when you're developing friendship, you're working on bonding, right? Bonding is made basically of experiencing things together, you know? Generally, there's some work to do, and you put into work with somebody else, and when work is done, you kind of go your separate ways. That's my experience anyway. Again, I got a very cold experience, a cold existence, but it's like that, but learning to build bonds also goes in like disclosing secrets and building trust, right? I tell you a secret about me and then I stand back and watch out and see like if that secret starts to be talked about and comes back to me. Then I'll know that you said something. Then I know I can't trust you, right? But if that doesn't happen, then I know I can trust you. It's all a matter of trust to divulge a little bit of information that's private and personal. And when it seems like it's okay, nothing's come of it, divulge a little bit more. And the more you do, the deeper the trust becomes. And the deeper the trust is, the more founded and precious the friendship becomes. And I found myself with these unattractive women that I was obliged to befriend, gaining more and more in trust. And these conversations started to yield some horrible facts, right? Horrible facts. Now, what we're talking about, when I'm talking about these friends who are women, I'm talking about recovering women, right? Recovering drug addicts, recovering alcoholics who come from a whole world of shit, of problems and issues, and they've made that great change, taking those steps forward to reestablish themselves and become something new. These are the people who I was hanging around with, right? I was practicing AA stuff on AA people, basically, and you know, some of the information I was gathering from these new friends was the fact that these women, one after the other, after the other, after the other, had all experienced some sort of traumatic abuse, molestation, rape, incest, all of that kind of stuff, right? in their lives. And that was an eye-opener to me, you know. And it's like I looked at it. It's like if there was 5, 6, 7 women that revealed that to me, then the other, like, 2, 3, 4 who didn't say anything like that, I might look at as if they didn't have those issues. But, and I would think that maybe 50, 60, 70% of the women in recovery have this past, and that's remarkably horrible. But thankfully, there was another 20, 30, 40% that didn't, you know. But the only reason I could come to that conclusion, a false conclusion, is that those other 2, 3, 4 hadn't had this conversation with me yet. I would in time come to find out that even those, right? Even those did too. There was even one in particular that just had her shit so together that there was no way that could have happened. Yep, even her too. So it's like almost 100%. There's got to be somebody that hasn't had that. But in my little snapshot, within my little cross-section of that society, it's like a damn near a slam dunk. You can count on it, you know? And it's just a horrible thing to do. Now, what happens with these people, right? What they all got in common? 2 things. Drug and alcohol problems and a past full of abuse. You would think that the abuse and the drugs and alcohol problem go hand in hand. One begets the other. First came the abuse, then came the drugs and alcohol, then came more abuse, right? And of course, you know, I talk much about unnatural behavior, changing out of a lifestyle of that. That's what these women were doing, right? They were in that same process of change that I was in, and they were moving out of that unnatural behavior. You know, would you start to center your existence around drugs and alcohol, right? And I talked about how we form up a religion, right? We all have this natural need, this natural desire for religion. What's different is whatever it is that we believe in. And when we come to believe in drugs and alcohol, they become our gods. They become idols to us. Just think about that guy sitting in the bar in the middle of the crowd, and you walk in the room and he has his can of Budweiser in his hand. He's the one who stands up, burps, and goes, "Budweiser, dude!" Right? That's a form of idolatry. He's expressing something. As sophomoric and ridiculous as it appears, it's really something deep down serious to that person. So we build up this religion around drugs and alcohol, and then we end up taking the drugs and alcohol out of the picture, having a big void in our lives, and having to reconstruct a religion around that void. That void is sobriety, recovery. And then the steps of AA function towards filling that void. Now, before that void gets appropriately filled, we inappropriately move to other diversions outside of drugs and alcohol to try to fill that void. So we get into sexual promiscuity. We get into gambling, you know. We get into like being workaholics. There's all kinds of variants, you know. When you get home, if you're young, video games for like 7, 8 hours. So you don't have to think about nothing. It's a complete escape. All diversions from reality, right? And yeah, just this fucking connection between abuse and then drug abuse and alcohol abuse later on. you're taking somebody who's innocent, and then when they're triggered later in life into their addiction, they become their own abuser. Excuse me, sorry. Self-abuse. That becomes self-abuse, right? Which is, of course, an unnatural behavior. You've got a problem person who was an innocent victim. Who is now turning the key and walking through the gateway of all kinds of immorality. When we're drinking, think about like the vulnerability, the vulnerable position we put ourselves in. Think about the volatility, our knee-jerk emotional responses to things that don't really add up. I talked about how easy it was to just have a date with a girl, get her a 4-pack of wine coolers, give her a line or two of cocaine, and she'll be doing anything. She'll be doing anything. That becomes a pattern of life for people. It's debauchery. I talked about like the grunge era with the ecstasy and then the resultant trisexuality, right? There was that period in time that kind of broke open the gates and kind of made the normalization of all kinds of immoral stuff possible that we're experiencing now in the 2020s, right? Normalization of all this stuff. Ecstasy puts you in that same vulnerability. So you get into these immoral lifestyles after have already incurring the traumatic psychic damage of the super unknown, as I say, right? Whatever happened, whatever form of abuse we took in our lives. We get into all these immoral lifestyles otherwise that just perpetuate the problems and the problems and the problems, right? And this is the shit that we all need to change out of. And, you know, these immoral lifestyles lead us into subsequent torment eventually, because that's the devil's game, to ensnare you into his ways. And before you realize what was going on, you're trapped in this torment, a slave to sin. And while you're so enslaved, you are getting by with whatever other immoral object you get your hands on to get you through the day and get you through the night. And you need that stuff, and you need it desperately, because why? You're quashing your conscience. When your conscience hits you, knock it back with pills, right? Or any other kind of diversion, really. But pills kind of obliterates it. It kind of cuts off any continuity between you and God. You know, even if you don't believe in God, God believes in you. God is there, and he's there, and he's there, and he's there, until one day your heart becomes hardened, and God is no longer there. God sees that you are irrevocably cut off and doesn't bother. He washes his hands of you and turns and goes the other way. That's the slippery slide of our immorality. You know? And we may be kind of whistling past the graveyard, even for many years, doing these things and thinking it's okay. We're all right. We're not so bad. But when you've already got some kind of routine that involves perversions, alcohol and drugs and all kinds of diversions in your life just to get through this day, when the unsettling moment, that soul-crushing, heartbreaking moment happens, something completely outlandish, totally unexpected befalls you, your reaction is bound to be not only what you have before you and what you know and what you're comfortable with, which are all these diversions, which include drugs and alcohol. And this is, you know, the slippery slope all of a sudden gets really fucking steep. It becomes like a free fall. You may not be an alcoholic, and you're probably not. Most people aren't, right? But it can happen to you. This is not a birth defect. This is not inherited. It's completely situational. It's really a matter of how much you come to depend on that and where that becomes like the centrifugal force in your life. It becomes where no moment you're going to bother with, no event you're going to attend will be bothered with or attended to without drugs and alcohol being involved. I use the term whistling past the graveyard. You know it. You know deep down. You know deep down. I know deep down if I am evading my conscience in any way. And that's the real kicker right there. If I'm in a habit of doing that, when the time comes, where I actually need to scream out to God, God may not be there to hear. So I speak about this place we may eventually come to when our souls, our spirits become irrevocable. The hardened heart, right? And the fact, or I should say to you all who don't believe, the idea that your soul can become irrevocable over time as the result of continually, year after year, denying your conscience from entry into your being means absolutely nothing to the person who is getting by on those means until the moment comes when we have the sense that our soul has been crushed. And if that moment somehow doesn't come, or if that moment comes but it just won't crush us, or because our resilience is so thick, it brings us right down to our deathbed. When we know there's nothing left but to die, and we believe in nothing except our own desires, we only have our own desires left to hang our hat on. And our final, last desire is what? To live. But we're going to die. Well, then what about afterlife? You've done nothing. You've done nothing to approach God on God's terms. You have no relationship with God. When it's time to change your mind at that point, right? We're talking about changes, changing your beliefs from one to another. That's absolutely hellish. You actually have, at that last moment of your breathing, hell on earth. And then the lights go out. I've always had it in my head, and I don't know how true this is, that you go out, experiencing here where you're going on the other side. If you're going to hell, for example, to some torment, some place of eternal torment, you're going to get a taste of that before the lights go out here. It's the last thing that you're going to know. And then you go. But I don't know how true that is. That is just mythology inside of my system since I was a little kid. You know? I guess the premise would be in that it all boils down to where you are at that last final moment. In Christian terms, that's perseverance in the faith. Holding fast unto the end. Not wavering. Always mindful of your situation in spirit. So that when your time comes, you're absolutely ready. And you fear nothing. I remember when I was going through my heart attack. I had been a saved Christian for in the neighborhood of 5 years at that point in time. A little more than 4 years, somewhere around 5 years, something like that. I had no fear at all. It never occurred to me to cling to life with everything I had for fear of what was to come. Not once. I didn't waver. I realized by my faith, I was happy to move on into the afterworld. And that's good knowledge to have. That's something really good to know about yourself. And that may be the great takeaway. There's many takeaways from that heart attack, but that may be the great takeaway. Just knowledge of my resolute faith. But man, to have that sense that you are irrevocable, whether it be at that last gasp for air while you're in your deathbed, or whether it be at some unexpected, very crushing moment in your life. The sense of unworthiness, undeserving, irrevocability that we have when finally we're ready to cry out to God is in and of itself a very crushing thing. It's debilitating. I've had, for probably a good 10 days now, kind of running through my head. I tell you, I always got a song in my head. And every day I tend to have like this, what I call the song du jour, right? Song of the day. That's my French for the day, by the way. I chip in a little bit of that every once in a while. My song du jour, I don't know, for like 6 days running, while I started doing this particular sequence of monologues, the Down Come series, right? It was the same song every fucking day. And then even since then, once it finally waned off and petered out, wasn't exactly the song du jour. It's still the song that I want to hear. So I'm going through my playlist. That one comes on. I don't skip it. I turn it up loud. And it's Korn, right? K-O-R-N. Korn. From their Untouchables LP in the early 2000s. A song called No One's There. This song, I think, expresses exactly what I'm talking about now. When I'm talking about that sense of unworthiness, that sense of irrevocability. Korn, of course, is like the premier, primary, most significant genre bursting band of the new metal genre. I think, anyway. I think new metal, first thing I think is Korn. No One's There is almost kind of sort of unusual Korn song. It's got the heaviness that Korn is known for, right? That's what new metal is, very heavy music. It's like Black Sabbath on steroids, it's, you know. Deeper, lower, more pounding, vocally more expressive. In fact, the vocalist for Korn, Jonathan Davis, very expressive, right? But this song, No One's There, the sound and feel of it, it kind of got like a little bit like a 80s kind of digital feel to it. Almost, you know, not quite like Casio keyboard, but I mean like there's a, during the main verses, I use that word recently about dehumanization, dehumanizing. Well, there's like a dehumanized quality to the vocalist's voice in the main verses of the song. Almost robotic, right? Which is a little bit different for them, right? You got that, like, 80s digital roboticness sense. And then also, it goes another direction, more towards the end. The Coolio, I'm not a rap guy, but he's got a song that I was familiar with back in the 90s. It was like the mid-90s, I think. Gangsta's Paradise. It had a certain uncommon, what's the word I'm looking for, almost like a symphonic element, not really, sort of, kind of, something ethereal, something on those lines in that song that when I hear No One's There, I'm reminded of Gangsta's Paradise, actually. And in both instances, it works very well. Works very well. Of course, anything new metal is going to have a sense of Anthrax in it. Anthrax may be the granddaddy of it all, right? If Korn is the icon of it, Anthrax is probably the granddaddy of it, new metal. And Anthrax, very rap-oriented, you know. And Korn songs do have rap in parts, sometimes here and there. Or rapish type of stuff. So it's really kind of going out in that direction. It's a different kind of song. But the lyrical theme of it, which is not uncommon in Korn songs, you know, very a hurt person, somebody who's in pain. Somebody's screaming out. Somebody's got anger and vengeance tied to that pain. And it's very emotional lyrics and vocalisms that Jonathan Davis puts forward. Very excellent. Really, very excellent. Really a sign of the times. Truly, truly. And one of the best, if not the best, expressions of it, vocally speaking. The lyrical theme here is feelings that can't be dealt with. An obvious reaching to God in prayer, but having those prayers unanswered. A desire to just flee everything and go somewhere and weep. This is it. This is the foxhole prayer I keep talking about. This is that bottom of the well, end of the road, and you've been running your bullshit all this fucking time, and now what? It's all come crashing down, and you've got this debilitating sense of being unworthy because the prayers that you even eke out, you have no sense of response from. In one particular lyric, right? It goes, "No one hears me call," echoes back at me, "No one's there," right? That's the prayer. Ain't praying to anybody who will listen at this point, right? So what's going on in that moment? You're crying out for help. You're done. You can't do it yourself no more. You're crying for help to anybody who will listen. And here's the point. You're not getting a response from God for one of two reasons. You're not coming to Him on His terms, or you're irrevocable. And now the rest of anybody not answering your prayers is all Kingdom of Satan shit, right? All demons. All evil spirits. All unclean spirits. That's what they are. And they're not going to come to your aid either, because they've done everything to bring you to that fucking point. What they hope for now is that you kill yourself, but before you do, you take somebody down with you. All of this, you know, recalls this whole sense that being there and having this sense of being irrevocable, not understanding. I did not understand God's terms. I understood about it, going to God on God's terms. I never knew what God's terms were. It's very important information to have, and that's why I get all preachy here on my monologue, right? Because the most important thing for me to do is to help people come to knowledge of the truth. That's what God wants for everybody. That is scriptural, what I just said right there. That is exactly what God, that's God's will for mankind, to come to knowledge of the truth. We're busy with all our diversions and trying to find ways to enjoy the lies, the deception of it all, and avoiding the truth, which comes to us by means of the conscience that we keep on knocking back with pills. When you do not understand about God's will in all of this, what I mean to say, when you do not understand about God's terms as being a part of this scenario of making proper connectivity and then enjoying proper communion with the Creator of all things, the only other thing left is the potential of being irrevocable. And if you spend a day or two screaming out to God from your foxhole, and it seems like nothing's coming back, there is no response, and you don't understand that God has terms to make this connection with, the only thing left to think is that you're unworthy. And now you're really alone. You know, it's fun. It's fun to flip tarot cards and cast spells out of books. It's fun to, well, I don't want to get all kinds of occult stuff, whatever, you know, whatever. It's fun to dabble in these things. It's fun to imagine yourself as some kind of warlock, whatever. On the other hand, it's fun to be atheist and rely completely on the world and bolster your ego with thoughts of your intellectual prowess and your educational history and the degrees and shit. That's all kind of fun. Until the moment comes. And because we've been so negligent and ignorant all along, when that moment comes, we don't know where we stand. When we don't get the answers right away, and we're not going to because we're not in communion with God. He's hearing you. He's there, unless you're irrevocable. And even then, he might be hearing you, but he'll never respond. Too late is too late. Man, I got to tell you. My mind is kind of like going 20 different directions right now. But I got to tell you, this state of mind that I'm describing to you right now, this moment in time, I actually spent years in that fucking cage. Years in that quote-unquote foxhole, screaming out to God. It wasn't just like one bad night after something happened. My soul was crushed, and I'm still trying to apply the principles of AA in my life, and I'm working out in the gym, and I'm doing everything I can to just hold myself the fuck together. And it was like easy 5 years of that, easily. And I started to come unglued when I lived down in Georgia. You know, I remembered it clearly. I really do not wish the agony of such moments on anybody. Even just a day of this is excruciating. But I know that I lived years of it. I must have been so very close to the precipice of actualizing hard-heartedness. I may have even crossed the fucking line. That it took that kind of dedication, screaming out to God. And that's one way of looking at it, of course. The other way of looking at it is, I didn't cross the line. I was missing the point. I was not understanding about the God's terms aspect. And it took me 5 years to learn what God's terms were. And not only that, but to actually be open to them. I got to tell you, I was willing to make direct connection with God. I just didn't want to have to go through Christ and Christianity to do it. I was opposed to that. Now, as I go through my day, I can't even get Christ out of my mind, ever. Completely 180, right? In relation to the corn song, you know, my life experience, that one moment in time that really describes it all. You may have heard me say it before, probably have. It's the demon bats from hell story. What's that? That's me leaving Georgia, going back up north. I met with the very same sponsor who, as a sponsor ought to do, asked me how it's going and asked me about my spiritual life or my prayer life, or wherever he wanted to put it that day, right? And my answer to him was basically, look, I try to pray to God every here and there, and every time I do, I just get this sense that my prayers just go up into the sky, and then these demon bats from hell come out, snag them before they get where they're intended to go, and tear them up, and that's the end of that. Nothing ever happens. I'm completely disconnected from God. You know, I'm surrounded by demons that are just not letting it get through. The demon bats from hell. And here's the torment, right? More lyrics from the corn song. No one's there, right? Where are you? My soul is bleeding. I am searching. Am I blind, right? The blind part. Think about that. God's terms. I was blind to what God's terms were. Am I blind? Yeah, I was. And it goes on, all right. Where are you? My soul is bleeding. I am searching. Am I blind? All alone and bound forever, trapped inside me for all time. That is what hard-heartedness is. It's being trapped inside of yourself. And what's all time? That's eternity in hell. And this, my friend, is Korn. And you never knew this about Korn and their songs. Of course, Brian Welch would go on to become very famous for his conversion into Christianity. a lot of nationally run, nationally marketed public service announcements, the I Am Second campaign. Oh, he's a guitar player from Korn. Head. Excellent to watch. Interesting dude. Trapped inside me for all time. Right? Now you have that sense of absolute godlessness. This is what I was starting to get to before. Our life is all fun and games, dabbling in any diversion that we choose to take interest in, rather than encounter faith in Jesus Christ. Pardon me. It's all fun and games. And it's all fun and games only because inherently, no different than we have an inherent sense of right and wrong, no different than we have the inherent conscience, we, because of our knowledge of our conscience, have an inherent understanding that God is always there and available at whichever point we should or should we decide to call out for Him. In other words, we know He's there. And I don't much care who the fuck you are. We know He's there. And I, for one, had gone through life with knowledge of Him being there. And I reckoned I can do whatever I want for as long as I wanted to, and not give a shit about that fact. And should the day come, for whatever reason, that religion starts to pull at me, well, he's right there. I'm a good guy. Pat me on the back, you know. But clearly, as you listen to my story, that's not the case. You know, it wasn't the case at all. We have this false sense of God's availability to us. The proximity is true. Yes, He is there. But we can get to a point where the availability is no longer there. And this is what we grapple with. This is what Korn is expressing in that song, No One's There. We finally come to that moment of calling out for God, and there seems to be no reply, right? No reply at all. What do I tell you about that? I tell you that there's two ways to look at it. You're either blind, like the song mentions, that you have no idea what God's terms are, so therefore you can't come to Him on His terms. Therefore, any connection you have with Him, it's going to be kind of one-sided. Your prayers come up, but the answers never come with you. And the sense of presence of Him is very diminished, if not completely invisible. And then the other thing is, yes, you are indeed irrevocable, totally unworthy. You of a hard heart, a wretched soul, a reprobate, all these things, right? You're closed off. In fact, in our society, right, when you become too far gone as such, when you have a hardened heart, the way we regard a person without with a hardened heart is a person without conscience, right? The conscience is actually God on board with us. Whatever that looks like exactly, I can't say, but that's basically what it is. Could it be your guardian angel, perhaps, right? The exact etudes of it all, I don't know. But the factitude is we have God on board with us inherently, and the conscience is that aspect of it. And if we blot that conscience out entirely, to the point where there is no conscience, Well, how do we in contemporary society regard that person that has no conscience? And I mean to say, like, in psychological terms, that is your ordinary, everyday sociopath, right? No remorse for the actions that they take at all. No conscience. That's your hard heart. So this is what we become in time, potentially. And if, like I said earlier, if that fails to happen for some reason, if we do not exactly cross that line into hard-heartedness, we have to take our life and everything right to the deathbed and then sort it out there in the 11th hour. The good news is it's not impossible. The bad news is it's not fucking likely that you're going to do it. And the rest of the bad news is you may not have that opportunity. Your lights may go out unexpectedly very quickly, and there's no time to, like, think about it all and reckon with yourself. You can have a car accident that tears your fucking head right off, and that's it. Lights out in an instant. Do you understand what I'm saying? So to this point, this entire Down Come series, the topics have been revolving and evolving around abuse and anguish, burnouts and recovering people, common bond and symptom of underlying problems, common bond of abuse, turning to drugs and alcohol, how hurt people, and how immorality begets immorality. And now, let's focus a little bit on hurt people, right? Because that's really the best way to kind of express what I'm focused on here. It's the idea of, like it says, hurt people who in kind turn around and hurt other people. Who in kind, right? And then so on and so on. And this is the mechanism by which the sin of the world rests on every one of us, you know, on our civilization as a whole. Like a blanket out of hell. And becomes the kingdom of Satan. It begins with the hurt we receive. And it moves forward with the hurt that we pay forward. Hurt people, hurt people. It's a basic premise behind everything I'm saying here. You know, we start off in the grunge era. Burnouts were grunge before there were grunge. And then the expression of the grunge era with all the pain and torment. All the psychological issues and general weirdness that was coming to light at that point in time, you know? Now, one of the classic moments in grunge era music history would be a Nine Inch Nails song from 94 on Downward, or further, the Downward Spiral, right? There was a Further Down the Spiral EP that came up after, something like that. I also had the Downward Spiral EP, 1994, Nine Inch Nails had the song Hurt on it, H-U-R-T, Hurt. And I guess you'd say, as far as Nine Inch Nails goes, that would probably be the Nine Inch Nails song that everybody lights their lighter to and sways back and forth, you know? Every band seems to have that one song that seems to touch everybody. And Hurt would probably be the Nine Inch Nails version of that. Nine Inch Nails is not the kind of music that you actually do that sort of thing to. So if you have gone to a concert, you wouldn't see that happening. But that would be like the closest you get to it, I guess you would say. And I remember, speaking of the Hurt song, right? And I did see Nine Inch Nails in concert when Nine Inch Nails was still Nine Inch Nails, like I like to say. It was in 1995 up in Jersey, and it was tremendous. It was absolutely tremendous, you know? Absolutely tremendous concert. Opened up. Well, actually, how did it go? Yeah, they opened up for David Bowie. Trent Reznor apparently is a big David Bowie fan. David Bowie was coming out of the woodwork after some years without really doing much of anything. And Trent Reznor decided to help, like, bring his new record up into notoriety by joining him on a tour. And at the beginning leg of the tour, he actually would open for David Bowie, as if David Bowie was the shit that people wanted to see. And it turned out not to be the case. They had to reverse that order. The night I was there, when Nine Inch Nails yielded to David Bowie, and you talk about anticlimactic, right? The rest of the concert really sucked. People were throwing shit at David Bowie. So whatever you think about David Bowie and all that, people were literally in the crowd, from the crowd, down there in the mosh pits, throwing shit at him. Whatever they had to throw, they were throwing at him. It was such a fucking drop-off. It was horrible, right? But, yeah, they did the Hurt song. They kind of twisted up the... How did they do it? I'm trying to think of some of the songs that were, like, really different. Well, Hurt, I think, ended up being, like, the transitional piece that went from the Nine Inch Nails set into the David Bowie. And what happened was David Bowie came out and they did like a duet of Hurt together, which made the song suck. And I think there was a certain pace to it that was a little bit too fast. Something was wrong with it. It was really a letdown. It was disappointing. And then it just got more disappointing from that point forward, and people were chucking shit at him. It was, you know, Nine Inch Nails set was incredible up to that point. The whole David Bowie thing kind of hurt it. You know, speaking of the Hurt song, right? You know, and I know that the best version of Hurt was done by Johnny Cash, of all people. I remember we had here in Post Arlen, Texas, up until only recently, it was sort of a Best Buy, but it was kind of more like a localized Texas thing. There were a couple of chain stores around, retail outlets around. Not a huge chain, but it's called Fry's Electronics. And the one local here, and I think the entire chain, but I'm not positive. I probably should have looked that up. Wasn't really in my plans to talk about. Over in Plano, across from Love and War in Texas, Fry's Electronics, right? I remember being in there. I was in there getting some kind of computer parts or gadgets or something like that a long time ago, right at the time when Johnny Cash's version came out. And I was standing in the line, and they had, like, you know, music just playing, you know, store music. And that song came on, and I'm listening to it, and, like, I know Nine Inch Nails. I know the song Hurt. I'm hearing the lyrics, but I'm hearing fucking Johnny Cash. And my mind just couldn't wrap itself around the whole fact of that experience at that moment. But I just settled into it, went with it. And I just, holy shit, this is really good. This is really fucking good. And from that instant, you know, that initial moment and forward on through time, I've never heard anybody do that song better. Trent Reznor did not do that song as good as Johnny Cash did. And that's saying something, because Hurt's a good song, right? Nine Inch Nails was introduced to me in my life by ways of dating a woman who happened to be a Wiccan, an actual witch. That was her favorite thing. And she was quite the deck of cards, this one, right? I would only come to find out in time It was the one and only shit where you eat or don't shit where you eat occurrence in my life, right? I got involved with somebody at the workplace and I learned a hard lesson. But this was not just some ordinary somebody, right? This was this girl had some fucking issues. She was straight up Generation X in the grunge era, you know, a bit younger than me, right? Younger Generation X. And but she was all about 9-inch nails all the time. And so she was the one that introduced me to 9-inch nails. And I really didn't take to it. That was not my kind of music. You know, I was easing my way into the grunge era, basically. I was not all that familiar with everything going on. I heard what I heard on the radio, and I don't believe I had any actual grunge CDs at that particular moment. What I did have was a Jane's Addiction CD or tape. Actually, it was probably I don't know. I had Jane's Addiction, Nothing Shocking, and that was kind of different for me, right? I was listening, you know, in those days, we're talking Metallica, Motorhead, Led Zeppelin. I had that Aerosmith pump that I mentioned earlier. That's the kind of stuff I was listening to. Very masculine stuff, right? And on the hard side, mostly. And Jane's Addiction, while it has some moments of like heaviness, it's kind of gayish. It's kind of girly. And I was playing that music. Like, I was in the parking lot. And this is kind of how this girl and I hit it off. This is why I'm saying all this, right? We walked out together from at the end of the workday, just talking about shit. And I got in my truck and I rolled down the window, and she was parked next to me, and she had her window rolled down. And I started up the truck, and the music that I had on happened to be Jane's Addiction. And I always played music loud, so it just came on right loud. She heard it right away. And she made mention of it like the following day that, hey, I heard you were playing Jane's Addiction. Is that right? And I was like, well, yeah. My friend turned me on to it. See, I would have never expected that from you, you know? And that's how it began, you know? That's how it began. And through that, she brought 9-inch nails in, which was very far removed from my taste. What I was experiencing at the time was predominantly the first release, which was called Pretty Hate Machine, which goes back to the late 80s, right? And it was very 80-ish, with the, you know, very digital sounding. Of course, Trent Reznor was like a digital music genius, a mastermind, a one-man band in a studio kind of guy. So a lot of stuff was done digitally, if not everything was done digitally, and it had a very digital feel to it. But it also was very emotional. It had a lot of edge and attitude. And there was just so much about it that just wasn't me. It didn't fit me. It didn't suit me. But there was one song, and this is how it happens, right? There was one song that grabbed me on that CD. It was the real mellowed out one. How does it go? I just want something I can never have. Right? So it didn't have all like that club kind of beat to it. It didn't have any kind of rap lyrics involved. It was really like way out there space music, you know? It was like Pink Floyd from the 70s almost, but with that little edge to it. And I liked it. That I liked. I mean, I really liked it. I liked it to the point where I like listened to it over and over and over again. And then eventually I was compelled to just buy the CD. And then from there, the other songs kind of caught on fire with me also. I started to relate to lyrics. And the reason I was relating to the lyrics was because this witch I was dating was literally a living, pretty hate machine. That's exactly what she was. She was all about that CD. And I think, honestly, in her particular brand of insanity, she was trying to be that person in the world. That's fucked up. I mean, if you understand, if you know that album and you understand what that is, Pretty Hate Machine, that's a girl who drives a guy fucking crazy. She was all suited up to bring on that fucking craziness. Now, the reason I want to get into the conversation involving this particular woman, right? That's just a little backstory, but there's a reason to it all. This is a person who was clearly hurt, right? And hurt a lot of times on multiple levels. And it could be said it may have been to the point with her that her conscience was seared, even at a young age. I hope for her sake that's not the case. She was an adopted child, which is problematic to begin with. That's one thing I know. At the one end of her life, and then at the other end of her life, at that time as it was supposedly a story where she was, as Generation X people would do, up in a club in Limelight in New York at a rave doing ecstasy, and supposedly she got raped there by somebody she kind of knew. And supposedly that made her pregnant, and supposedly she had to deal with the kid, you know, an unexpected, unwanted pregnancy at a young age. She did the right thing and saw it through and put the child up for adoption, which of course is another painful experience. It's against nature, you know, to deny your maternal instinct. And everything maternal happens naturally when you get pregnant. Hell, I've seen that in my little Chihuahua dog, Coco. She had puppies. She, at 1 year old, knew exactly what to do. She was instant mother. It was incredible to watch. I'm sure human motherhood is very similar. It's the right thing to do if you can't or you're not willing for whatever reason to try to raise the baby on your own, to at least give birth to it and put it up for adoption and give some couple who can't have children the opportunity, right? That's basically a good thing. But of course, that's harmful. And so when I talk about harm on so many different levels with her, I don't know all the different levels of harm she experienced in her life, but I do know at that point she had some, and in the beginning, being an adopted child is a harmful thing to have to go through. I don't know it personally, but I've seen the results in so many cases. Now, I used to hate this person as a result of the way things turned out. I had fiery, violent feelings that I just could not vanquish. But that changed a long time ago. I remember the moment that it did. I'm not going to talk about that, but I remember the moment that it changed. And I could tell you it was in the year of 1997. So it was a good solid, like, almost 2 years after the whole thing fucking fell to pieces. Which, in retrospect, really wasn't that bad of a job on my part to get over it. But man, the time it took to get over it, I was so fired up. I was so full of hate. I literally took on her hate. And that's an important part of this story here, all right? It's part of the idea of hurt people, okay? She was a hurt person. And the reason she was with me, see, the relationship had no actual authentic basis to it. It was this dystopian nightmare fantasy in her little head. I would only come to find out later. See, it turned out that I somehow resembled her so-called rapist. And I say so-called because, oh, here's the rest of the story. Hold on, before I get into that. She had a boyfriend. She had a boyfriend, and she had had this boyfriend for 5 years prior. It was like the high school sweetheart. They were together forever. They did, you know. They were, she was family with her boyfriend's family and everything like that. Meanwhile, she's establishing a relationship, establishing the footing for a relationship with me at the workplace based off of... or starting with, you know, originating with the Jane's Addiction music. And she's telling me all along that she has broken up with her boyfriend because she cheated on her and got some girl pregnant. So she's ready to move on. This is what I understand going into this. And then we start kind of dating, like developing a relationship, right? And it turned out to be a little bit different than that. What ended up happening was she was the one who got raped. And in that ex-boyfriend or that boyfriend's mind, she really just was fucked up and got laid and ended up getting pregnant. It wasn't really a rape after all. Right? But she's crazy enough, right? She was crazy enough to make it very believable that a rape had occurred there. I wasn't there, I don't know, but this is the kind of mishmash story I get. We'll just call it the rape and we'll run with that, right? She got raped. She got raped by some guy that she kind of sort of knew. And it turned out that I resembled that guy. Are you starting to get where I'm going with this? So even though she had a boyfriend who she'd been with for 5 years, right? She was taking out vengeance on that dude who got her pregnant, possibly raped her, on me because I resembled that guy. And, you know, after about 5 or 6 months of going through all this fucking bullshit, and it was the most unusual and disgusting and fucked up relationship I ever had, in the end, I was able to get together with her boyfriend. And she stayed with him while she was with me. It was incredible. It was incredibly disgusting, the thing she was doing. She was literally fucking, at a minimum, two guys in the same day, many days out of the week. Unfucking believable, right? This is insanity. I was able to get with this guy at the end of it all, and we put our stories all together and figured it out, you know? I had all his missing pieces, he had all mine, and that was it. You know, that was the end of it. The point I'm trying to make here is that there was misapplied vengeance, right? I'm making the supposition that she was avenging the hurt that happened to her by taking it out on me because I looked like and resembled this guy, which is something that the boyfriend told me. You know, you kind of look like the guy. And then, after we went Splitsville, yet we were working in the same building, she started seeing another guy who was literally the redheaded fucking version of me. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. The same hair, except red. Physique, you know, he's built up. He obviously lifted weights. He had a little white truck, exactly like I had. It was just like my fucking redheaded twin in the world. And she managed to find her way, lickety-split, into that guy's fucking bed. To do the same damage. And the first time I ever laid eyes on that guy, I knew he was with her. Why? I walked out. He was smoking a cigarette. He was sitting down outside our office building, and he had his head down in his hand, and he was just kind of shaking his head back and forth like he was mulling over something impossible to figure out. And I knew at that moment, he is fucking her. He is now tangled up with the pretty hate machine, and this is what it's doing to him. It's misapplied vengeance she took out on me. Misapplied vengeance she took out on him. And I don't know how that turned out, but it couldn't have been good. Couldn't have been good. Because it was vengeance. We're going to talk about vengeance. But that was some kind of expression of hers, of lashing out at the entire world, but limiting it to specifically anything, anybody or anything that reminded her of her moment of pain and hurt. And she was harming innocent people in a way. I was innocent of her. I wasn't a perfect being, and I had all these fucking problems, you know, and I was an antichrist myself, and fairly early in recovery. I was, 5-6 years? Something like that. But in my 20s, and it was a hell of an experience, like literally a hell of an experience, probably worth having, but very, very destructive, very, very harmful. It was challenging. You know, it was literally the devil challenging every step I had taken in the right direction towards my saving faith. Though I wasn't at saving faith yet, I was moving there like I had explained earlier. You know, I had just a simple couple little seeds of faith that God recognized and started drawing me into the right direction. Kept walking with me in spite of myself. That was all being challenged and threatened on a daily basis by the lies that this woman was telling, the shit that she would do, you know. And I don't even need to get into details. It's not about that. It's not about me bemoaning that whole thing. I'm over it. I'm long over it. But it's a story worth telling when you're talking about A, Nine Inch Nails, B, hurt, C, hurt people, right? And now we're getting into this idea of like being harmed and being innocent of it again, right? It all starts from somewhere in the childhood. Some unknown, the super unknown. Something happens to hurt us. Or we do know about it. And it happens and it hurts us. And it really becomes like a driving force in our lives that we have to contend with. There's psychic repairs that have to be done. And we have no fucking idea what to do. We turn to drugs and alcohol and all these kind of things like that as we go on our lives. Even when we try to make the right turn and get things going in a proper direction. To even like so much as get right with God. You can still, as an innocent person, be attacked in such a way, and new psychic damage can be hit on you. You know, no, I wasn't exactly raped per se, but a very damaged person, possibly a sociopath, came into my life with the intent to do me harm. And I stood there holding a bag of evil. It was her evil. I tell you, sin, evil is a contagion that travels between people. The lines of sin moving person to person create the network of a web of sin in this world that blankets the entirety of civilization. This I believe. That's what the world is. It is literally this network of bonds between people that demons travel across and through. And it's as if it's a contagion. My priest, my Orthodox priest, regards sin as a sickness. So I don't think it's outlandish of me to take it to the step of it being a contagious thing. Evil is done to a person, now evil has done harm to a person, and the person who has been harmed is standing there with this tremendous sense of anger and vengeance, of having had been violated, and it is such a raging inferno that you've just got to do something with it just to get it off your own fucking plate, because it takes a huge man to carry that shit, bring it down to a low flame, and tamp it the fuck out. Few of us are big enough to do that. Unfortunately, that's exactly what we have to do. Now, of course, I was innocent in that regard, and I was left carrying this bag of this probable sociopath's fucking sin. Her contagion left onto me. And it was my great challenge and my attempt in my recovery, being sober through all of this insanity, to try and stop that evil in its tracks, to try to do exactly what I just described, to put that fucking fire out. But you know what? I couldn't do it. I couldn't just eat it. I ended up paying it forward. It's like another Nine Inch Nails song. Gave up, right? I tried. I gave up. It's on the Broken EP, 1992. I've mentioned that before, previous episode. I tried. I gave up. I tried. I went just about the whole summer eating that shit. And then I gave up. Couldn't do it. That flame would not go out. That was the most insane insanity anybody ever laid on me. And I would pay it forward, but I would disseminate it in a lot of different directions through acts of promiscuity. That's what I did. I was never really a promiscuous person for all the girlfriends I had in my life, but I had this moment in my life where I just, every weekend, somebody else. And that hurts. Women generally don't just crawl up into bed with you. I mean, it happens. But generally, they got an eye, and they got a want, they got a desire. And when they do that, they're hoping for something more. And when they hear within a week that you've done it with somebody else, that's a heartbreak, a disappointment. They get angry, they get hurt. And you see what I did? I took the hurt from the witch, and from the pretty hate machine, and I passed it on. I passed it on to another person. Then the next weekend, I passed it to another person. And just I was just divvying it out, little by little, kind of spreading the wealth. And then the lion's share ended up on somebody else, who I ended up in a relationship. Her proximity was too close for too long, and she ended up walking away with the rest of it. I was absolved, but I did my job. I paid it forward, and I paid it forward widely. That's a fail. That's a big fucking fail in my life. I was not big enough. I had no Christ in me at that time, you know. This time, maybe I'd do better. That time, I did pretty good. A couple of months of that shit, but, you know, and I just remember that whole summer. My motto that summer was homicide better than suicide. I was always suicidal. This I really did not need in my life at that time. But I was so mad. Instead of turning it on me like I normally would do, I was ready to turn it on the world. And that's what's incredible. I ended up not doing the world harm for like 3 months. And then when I did the harm, I did it through relationships rather than actual physical violence, which is what I wanted to do. I wanted to hurt people in a bad way. Hurt people, hurt people. Hurt others like you've been hurt. Hurt people, hurt people.
The Downcome series continues in the next release of Post-Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postharlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postharlan.com.